with the 20th pick in the NFL draft, the Philadelphia Eagles select.
You're listening to the Journey to the Draft podcast, presented by AAA.
Every athlete has a journey. Focus on the game. Let us worry about getting you there. Auto repair, roadside assistance, and auto insurance. Start your journey at AAA.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of the Journey to the Draft podcast presented by AAA. I'm Chris McPherson, and I have alongside my usual cohorts, Fran Duffy.
Hey, Chris.
And Bo Wolf.
Hello.
But our special in-studio guest this week, none other than NFL Films senior producer, Greg Cosell. Greg, welcome
to the podcast. Good to be with you guys.
Yes. You and Bo filmed the Draft Film Room series, so you got an in-depth look at the upcoming prospect, the top prospects in this year's draft class. But we really wanted to bring you on because you have such a unique insight where you watch the entire NFL all season long. You devour the tape. And then you transition to the college game and you get to see all the top college prospects. What are some of the traits, what are some of the themes that you see when you make that jump going from the NFL game and watching that through the course of the season to the college game as you, you know, really pack it in for those couple months there?
Well, I think you have to start with the fact that the college game and the NFL game are different. And it's becoming increasingly so each and every year. And I've actually talked with a lot of coaches about this, and they see it as well, and particularly on the offensive side of the ball. So very often when you look at college tape and you start analyzing certain positions, let's say quarterback, even offensive line to some degree, you're seeing things in college that you don't see in the NFL and that these players are going to have to do differently when they get to the NFL. And you can kind of reduce it this way. Two things really stand out with the college game. First of all, the college game tends to be played on the perimeter, and the NFL game is played in the middle of the field. Secondly, college defenses, they're structured more based on field versus boundary concepts because of where the hash marks are in college, whereas NFL defenses are not structured as much on field to boundary concepts. They're structured more on personnel and formation concepts. So the games are different, and you have to understand that when you start watching the college tape.
So, Greg, you watch the tape. When it comes to those comparisons between what you see on tape in college and in professionals in the NFL, what positions are the most similar?
Well, I think playing man-to-man coverage is, you can see clear analogies because in college very often you see a lot of man because the field's so wide. Particularly with these spread offenses, you know, a team like Baylor with Art Briles with that spread offense, you pretty much have to play man-to-man on the outside. You can't play zone, particularly to the wide side of the field. You don't have enough space. Mm-hmm. So you can look at corners playing man-to-man coverage. I think depending on the style of offense, I think running back skill sets, okay. You can certainly look at running backs. You always have to be careful in spread offenses with how many times running backs just run downhill through gaping holes, but I think you can see running back skills. Obviously, if I was talking corners, wide receivers still have to separate and run routes. You can get a feel for that, but I think the quarterback position is so different in many cases that anybody who doesn't believe that if you play in a spread offense that quarterback is a projection, then I think they're wrong. They're missing the boat. Those kinds of quarterbacks in spread offenses in college are all projections to the NFL.
Well, the other funny thing about the quarterbacks is it because there are so many teams and every team has to have a quarterback, it affects how you judge every position because if you judge a wide receiver but the quarterback can't get him the ball,
right,
is lobbing balls up, or you know, how do you judge a safety if the quarterback's not, you know? And I know it's funny.
Point.
It's funny to listen to, you know, sometimes Fran will just be watching tape and just start laughing because the quarterback is so bad.
Well, like, that's true.
Just like, that, it's like, oh my God, what is this?
I didn't really want
like,
to say that, but now that
well,
you've gone there,
we don't have to single guys out.
Now that you've gone there, that the one of the first things I notice as soon as I start watching college tape, unless you know you're watching the one or two or three quarterbacks in a given draft who are the good players, is I just say, God, the quarterbacks in college are so bad. Because
like to go from watching Aaron Rodgers to watching Shane Carden, like it's like, well, what are we doing here?
You know, and again, it's because the game is different. You don't have to be a great thrower of the football to be a good college quarterback. That's
right,
just the
right.
reality of the situation. And for the most part in the NFL, you have to be a pretty darn good thrower of the football if you're going to be a top 10 or top 12 NFL quarterback.
And one thing we've talked about in the past on the Eli in the Sky podcast, Greg, is what the future is for the NFL because of where college football is nowadays, where, you know, what are you going to do in a few years when Peyton Manning's gone, Tom Brady's retired, a number of these other quarterbacks are starting to get up there in years. But if the college football is still supplying guys like a Brett Hundley, like a Bryce Petty, guys that still need to be developed and matured a little bit, you know, where is the pro game going to go?
And that's a great point. That's something I've been thinking about a lot this college offseason as I've watched tape is and I talked with a couple of coaches about this, if you're not comfortable with your quarterback for whatever reason, whether the learning curve, whether he's just not good enough, are you going to ask that guy to drop back 35, 38, 40 times in a game? Because what's the last thing coaches want? Turnovers, right?
Right.
I mean, if you don't turn the ball over, theoretically, you at least have a chance to compete and win a football game. So if you're not real comfortable with your quarterback, does the NFL game sort of become cyclical again and go back to the running game? Now, there's all kinds of ways to run the ball. I'm not suggesting we're looking at Vince Lombardi's power sweep, but does the running back then, supposedly having been marginalized over these last number of years, does the running back, and this is obviously a really good year for backs, does that become a more important position again because you don't want quarterbacks dropping back that many times?
You bring up a great point, because has the running back really been marginalized, or is the talent level that's been available? You look at last year's free agency, Ben Tate,
right,
Toby Gerhart, the Bishop Sankey was the top one in the draft. This year, you see what the Eagles made in free agency,
right,
DeMarco Murray, Ryan Matthews, two Pro Bowl guys. You see guys like Todd Gurley, Melvin Gordon, you know, T.J. Yeldon, the top backs are available this year. Do you just think that it's just that wasn't a good year previously for backs?
I would tend to agree with that, C-Mac, because I don't think the position's been marginalized. I still think, and I think if you talk to coaches, they'll tell you that you have to run the ball. And, I mean, look at the Dallas Cowboys, okay? Obviously, DeMarco Murray's here in Philadelphia. But DeMarco Murray was the foundation of that team, not just of that offense, of that team, because they had to protect their defense. So they went from a team that's been a 500 team essentially over the last 4, 5, 6 years to a team that was 12-4 and won a division because they ran their offense and their team through a running back. Now, not every year is a back going to carry 392 times. That's very rare. But that's what happened last year. And I think teams are realizing that in the NFL, you still have to line up and run the ball, and more often than not, that run game has to be effective between the tackles. You don't get on the perimeter in the NFL in the run game as your run game foundation.
I don't think the position is marginalized. I just think the talent available at the position is deeper than it is. The difference in productivity for your NFL offense between the number one running back and the number 15 running back probably means less to your team than the difference between the 1 and 15 quarterback or the 1 and
right.
15 offensive line or wide receiver. I think you can still be productive with your running game if you have a okay running back, better than you can at other positions.
And that may be true. And I think then that you have to decide if you're comfortable with that. But I think if you have a major commitment to running the ball and a quality back, not a great back, then you can probably have a successful run game. The question is, how successful, and can that be your foundation, or is it kind of a compliment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look at the Seattle Seahawks, and I know Fran and I have discussed this. Are there 10 guys that could do what Marshawn Lynch does in Seattle? Now, maybe some people would say yes, but are there 10 guys who can do that? Are there 10 guys that could have carried 392 times last year as DeMarco Murray did?
No, I don't think so.
So ultimately, you have to decide, you know, the draft always leads to a lot of philosophical comments, a lot of platitudinous comments that are thrown out there that may or may not be true. That's this time of year. And it's kind of accepted over the last number of years that the running back position is no longer important in the NFL because you can't compete without a quarterback. And again, I'm not suggesting that the running back's more important than the quarterback, but if there's fewer and fewer of those quarterbacks to go around, how does that impact team building?
You mentioned one position where the traits seem to carry over from the college game to the pro game, and that's at wide receiver.
It can.
It can.
Yes.
More seamlessly than other positions. And last year we saw a wide receiver draft class for the ages. Eagles had Jordan Matthews come and make a major impact. You saw all the receivers who went in the first round. This year's draft class seems to be good once again. Why do you think the wide receiver position seems to be, I don't want to say more of a sure thing than in previous years, but again, it seems like the transition seems to be more seamless in recent years than
two things come to mind. I think more man coverage in college, so guys have to run routes against man. And number two, I think the lines in the NFL have been blurred between what you'd call a number one receiver and the other receivers on the team because of how often teams throw the ball and how multiple teams have become formationally. You know, I think that there's a certain core group of big-time receivers in the league, but there's not 30 of those guys. There's, I don't know, five? And then I think you get into a situation where, depending on use of personnel, formations, is different guys can line up in a lot of different places and be used in a lot of different ways and be successful catching passes. We know in the NFL that a lot of guys catch a lot of balls. That doesn't mean there's 50 really top receivers, but a lot of guys catch a lot of balls. So there's room in the NFL, based on the way offense is played, for receivers to come in and be contributors.
It's just funny because we've talked about that in the past couple of weeks is, you know, you look back over the last 5 years and some of the receivers that have come out in the first round, and it used to be the years ago, you know, 10 years ago, we'll say, that the wide receiver position was viewed as a spot that, you know, was very, it was a high bust rate.
Right.
In, you know, early in the draft, it was a very, you know, it was a big position for high bust rate. You can look at, you know, the Troy Williamsons and the, you know, the Mike Jenkins of the world. And, you know,
Darius Haywood Bey was a top 10 pick.
Sure, exactly. You know, so you look at that group of guys that went in the top 30 picks of the draft. But now, you know, that hasn't been the case over the past few years. A lot of these receivers have transitioned easily. And then you look at the offensive line, which previously was viewed as, oh, if you want a safe pick, go to the O-line. Whereas if you look over the last 5 years, the offensive line, that has not been the case in the top 30 picks. So many offensive linemen have busted out. Why do you think that that's been the case?
Well, I think that's just one thing that comes to mind is the way college offense is played. There are still schools that run what would be considered pro-type offenses, you know, the Georges, the LSUs, the Alabamas, the Stanfords, and I know I'm missing a bunch,
right.
But those kinds of schools. But then there's so many schools now that run some form of spread. And I think that the skill set required to play in the spread on a consistent basis, not that they never run the ball, but I think it's different. Very often there's wider splits. Just the way offensive linemen play in college over the long haul is often different than what they're asked to do in the NFL, so I think the projection becomes a little more difficult.
Exactly. It's just like with quarterback. It's
right.
Not that those guys can't do it. It's
right.
Not that they can't, but it just makes the project. It makes it a more cloudy projection for the transition.
No, we get into that every year, Fran, and you and I have discussed this over and over about left tackles, you know, because everybody thinks the left tackle position you want, you know, a dancing bear with really, really light feet. There's not a lot of those guys. So there's a lot of guys who play left tackle in the NFL who are not dancing bears, but they're good left tackles. You know, Andrew Whitworth with Cincinnati comes to mind. Really solid NFL left tackle. But if he was coming out in a draft, you wouldn't say, oh, that guy's a top 10 pick, because you just wouldn't project him that way based on his athletic skill set. And that's why when you look at a lot of guys in this draft who play left tackle in college, and so many people are so quick to say, oh, they're not going to play left tackle in the NFL. Well, maybe they are, because the game and the pass game, by the way, in the NFL, there's a lot of more quicker throws, too. So this idea of pass protecting for seven-step drops where you have to hold the protection 3+ seconds, not a lot of teams really do that.
So if I asked you what is the most difficult position to project for you, because you watch the tape, would it be the offensive line or safety?
Safety, I find really hard, and I'll be the first to admit it. Offensive line.
Everybody says that.
Yeah.
It bears out in the NFL because there are, you know,
yeah. I would
20
say
yard safeties.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know.
I would say offensive line for me as well can be difficult because, the reason it is you have to try to figure out, and I talk to coaches about this, but it's not like I'm on the phone every day, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be doing any work.
Because you have to watch the tape.
Yeah, I have to watch the tape. But to me, the big question with offensive linemen is what can be coached and what can't be coached. And I'll be the first to admit, sometimes I don't feel like I have a great handle on that. I don't know about you, Fran, when you watch, but you know, you can see a guy who's really athletic. I think most people can see that. You can usually see a guy that's not real athletic. I think most people can see that. It's the gray area where a guy is, you know, pretty good, but then you start looking at techniques, and then you start to think, okay, you know, if he doesn't use his hands well, can you theoretically teach that? Well, the answer is probably yes, you can, but does that mean he's going to apply it? Well, maybe it's ingrained in him to use his hands a certain way, and it's not going to change. That's the kind of stuff where sometimes I say to myself, gee, I'm not real sure. You know, a perfect example is someone like Jake Fisher, who's played right tackle for 2 years at Oregon and this year played left tackle. There's a guy who keeps his hands really low when he pass protects. Now, it's easy to say, well, he needs to strike with his hands and get them higher quicker. Maybe an offensive line coach would tell me, oh, I can teach him that in 2 weeks and he'll be fine. That's the kind of stuff I struggle with, because if he can't be taught that and he keeps his hands where they are, he's going to have a hard time because people are going to get into his chest.
And that's one of the things whenever, I mean, obviously you talk to coaches around the league more than, you know, much more than I do. And whenever I talk with anybody that's been at the league and it's been at the college level, I always want to ask them, you know, depending on what their position of expertise is, are there certain technique points that maybe are harder to teach than others, or ones that you are bigger red flags for you than others? You know, if a guy, like you said, if an offensive lineman doesn't use his hands, if a corner doesn't stay low in his pedal, right, things like that, are there things that you're more willing to look past when you're trying to project a guy to the NFL?
Yeah, and that's always a hard question. I'm glad you brought up corners, because sometimes, you know, you see guys who are really athletic, and you and I have talked about, oh, but his technique is bad, or he does this, he does that. And then I think to myself, well, gee, but there's not a lot of guys 6'1", 205 who move like that. So therefore, that guy's going to get drafted pretty high. But if he doesn't correct what you see on film, then no matter how athletic he is, he won't be a good NFL corner. So those are the hard questions in evaluation. And, you know, the other thing, and it gets back, C-Mac, to the question you started with about watching in college, you have to be real careful basing evaluations on college production, because the games are different. So let's say you're watching a linebacker. Just to say, well, he gets 13 tackles a game, that doesn't mean he's going to be a good pro.
Yeah.
You know, would you prefer to see production as opposed to no production? Yes, you would.
But you need context.
You need a context.
Reminds me of Fran's favorite, Max Bulla.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. that's a good point.
I mean, there's, you know, and I think that really holds true at linebacker, which, of course, Max Bulla was. Because
now
I
he's a defensive tackle. Was that
shot fired.
You know, so
trying to back
that,
up
that position, I think, C-Mac, is really educational when it comes to statistics, because a lot of college linebackers put up huge tackle numbers. You know, you see, you pull up the stats, which I always pull up the stats before I watch a game, just to get a baseline of the game before I watch a game, because, Bo, I watch the tape.
You do watch the tape?
Yes.
So, and so, you know, I'll often see linebackers, you know, 17 tackles, and then I watch the tape, and I feel like sometimes, not all the time, but, God, where was the guy? He got 17 tackles, but I'm not really noticing him watching the film.
Right.
Go ahead.
You know, you have to be careful with certain things.
The flip side to that is, especially at that position, you can't just say, okay, this guy's got great athleticism, he tested off the charts,
right,
put him in at the next level, because it's a position where instincts more important than production, obviously. But just because the guy tests off the charts, got a great NFL body, if he doesn't know where the play is going, and if he gets sucked in on play action every time, he's not going to be able to play to that athleticism.
No, and it's funny you mention that, because that's something I look at with defensive linemen. There's a good bunch of guys who might have really good initial quickness off the ball, and you go, wow, that's a really good trait to have, which it is. But then what happens is, then, you know, the offensive lineman maybe gives him a shove or recovers, and then what happens next? So you have to, there's a lot of defensive linemen who have initial quickness, but then they have no secondary quickness and they can't find the ball. And in the run game, it's usually a good idea to be able to find the ball.
But now, going back to the whole production aspect of it, you look at the defensive line, I'll take a guy like Eric Armstead out of Oregon.
Yep.
Where reading some of the evaluations of him, think that he should have been more productive with the size, the talent that he has.
Well, productive meaning more tackles. Because if you
more
you know,
of an impact of the game doesn't
right.
have to necessarily be tackle sacks, but
right.
more of an impact on the game, I guess.
Well, then you have to watch the tape, and I'm being honest here, and I know we've joked about it, but very often defensive linemen, whether it's a pass rusher, he's not a true pass rusher in a strict sense, but often this is the case with pass rushers too. A lot of people say, oh, he only had 9 sacks or 7 sacks and he should have had 20. Well, then I'll watch a game and I'll see that the guy is winning, beating his tackle consistently and getting really good pressure on the quarterback, or the defense is constantly sliding the protection to, the offense is constantly sliding the protection to that guy. So, you know, unless you're watching the game, you don't know the player's impact on the game by looking at the stat sheet.
And sometimes that's, especially with sack production, and I'm thinking this too because I'm kind of going through the edge rush position again. You know, you see some of these guys who had 16 sacks in the season, and you're watching, and it's like, okay, well, here are 3 sacks that he made coming up against the tight end. You know, it was a Pac-12 tight end that's never going to play in the NFL. And then here's another one where he beat the running back. Here's two where he beat an offensive tackle that was 3 seconds late off the ball. And it's like, okay, well, where is the sack that's going to translate to the right NFL? Some of that stuff, you have to be able to see those
traits. That's a great point. I make it the point with all so-called pass rushers to look at all their sacks.
Yeah.
Because I want to see how they got them.
Right.
You know, and I remember watching Trent Murphy at a Stanford last year, who ended up playing significantly for the Redskins because Arakpo got hurt. And I think he had 14 and a half or 15 sacks, and everybody talked about what a great pass rusher he was, and I watched all his sacks. And I think, if memory serves me correctly, on two of them, he actually beat a tackle. The other 13, whatever the number was, were either secondary sacks based on hustle, which, by the way, that's great. I mean, you want a guy to hustle.
Sure.
Or somebody, he got a pass rush from the other side, pushed it into him. So you watch that and you say to yourself, okay, so now if you're going to say he's a pass rusher in the NFL, at some point you have to win against tackles. Just like a receiver in the NFL, if you're watching a guy in college, he's going to have to win against man coverage. A corner, you have to see a guy and feel good about his ability to play man coverage. There are certain things you have to see when you watch guys and where you can say to yourself, that translates to the NFL.
Speaking of the edge guys, you focus on the tape primarily. Do you weigh in the measurables? Because it seems like at the edge rusher positions that there are certain athletic traits, certain athletic measurables that players need to have to make the transition to the next level. Or at least it seems right. Like historically that it seems consistent that certain timing and testing drills correlate right. To success from college to the NFL. Do you weigh that aspect in your evaluation when seeing – where a guy fits, where you might say he looks great on the tape, but you know what? He didn't run the three cone in this time. He didn't do the short shell in this time. There's a red flag there.
I start with the football. I watch the tape first. Then I will look at combine numbers or pro day numbers to see if they match up. You know, if you're watching a guy on film, and let's say he's a pass rusher, the position you brought up, and you're watching him and he can't, you see he doesn't have much flexibility, he doesn't bend, he doesn't have explosion. As a football player, I'm talking about watching the tape. And you watch 4 or 5 games and you don't see it. If I then look at his measurables and he has good measurables based on explosion, movement, and there's a total disconnect there, I'll go with the tape because that's how the game is played. So I'll always refer to the tape, but yes, C-Mac, I will look at measurables, but after I watch the tape, because the thing that, and I know Fran would probably agree with this, you don't want to get caught up in having a preconceived notion about a player
right.
Before you watch the tape, because ultimately we're playing football. We're not doing it, you know, in the fourth quarter when you need a pass rush, they don't put the cones out there. You've got to beat an offensive tackle, or you got to beat an offensive, whatever it may be. So I want to see him play football first.
I think the follow-up question is, is it pass rush the position where you pay most attention to measurables, or is there another position where you keep an eye on it most?
No, because I think with pass rush, and I wouldn't say I pay attention to measurables at a high level for any position.
Of course.
But I think pass rush, and I've talked to a lot of coaches about this, including Bill Davis, very often there's pass rush that is kind of intuitive and instinctive. Guys, and the term that's used is he a natural pass rusher? And it's hard to explain that specifically, you know, what series of traits make a guy a natural pass rusher, but you can see it when you watch film. Very often there's guys who test really well and are athletic, appear to be athletic, but they're not very good pass rushers because they can't bend exactly the way you want them to. They don't have a sense of how to work their hands and their feet together in order to beat an offensive tackle. So That's why you have to always start with the tape and ultimately, in my view, finish with the tape.
We've talked a lot in this podcast about the player versus prospect.
Right.
How do you define the term upside? That's something that we've also discussed right. here. How do you define upside when it comes to a player?
Well, to me, everyone's a prospect. And I never deal with any college player as anything other than a prospect because they've never set foot on an NFL field. Your question then comes back to what you feel can be coached, how much a guy has played, if he has a lot of room just for natural improvement. So you try to get a feel for that. You watch someone like Amari Cooper, the Alabama receiver, who at this point in time is very polished and refined in the subtle nuances of how to run routes and how to set up corners. So you watch Amari Cooper, and you really like what you see, but you say to yourself on a certain level, yeah, he'll be a really good NFL receiver, but are we watching what he is? Is he going to be better than he is now? Now, what he is now is going to be very good in the NFL, but is he going to be better? You watch, other receivers like maybe Kevin White fits into that category, maybe Breshad Perriman, and you say there are certain elements of their game that they need a lot of coaching, they need a lot of refinement, and when they get that, if they get there, there's no guarantee they get there, and that's why scouting and evaluation, no one's 100%. This is hard, believe me. You think to yourself, if Breshad Perriman gets there, could he be better than Amari Cooper? I think he personally could be. I don't know Breshad Perriman. I don't know his work habits. I don't know if he takes his craft seriously. I don't know if he'll apply what he's taught. That's the stuff I don't know. But I watch film and I see a guy and I say, those traits that I see on film, which I don't see often enough, are really, really good. And if he can get there, he could be terrific.
All right, so we're doing the show a little bit different today. Typically, we delve into the latest headlines and things like that, but since we have Greg in studio, we want to formulate things a little differently. But one of the things we want to keep consistent is our On the Clock.
On the Clock.
All right, Greg, you ready to play some games?
Well, apparently I'm going to be ready whether I want to or not.
That's exactly right. Okay. Today's game, Greg, we're going to give you our standard game, our trademark game. It's a game called Would You Rather. Now, I know that there are many, there's a lot of hemming and hawing you'll do when it comes to answering questions. You'll say, well, it depends on the system. My job is not to project where players
will be picked.
So you
don't
want
me to hem and haw?
They will, my job. Well, we just want to put you on the record here. Okay?
You want to put me on the spot.
Exactly. And we're all going to answer, so you're not alone.
Okay.
So the idea here will be you're picking for the Eagles, for the Eagles system, so you know who you're picking for. And I'm going to give you some different scenarios. You tell me which scenario you would prefer, and we'll all answer. The first one, would you rather, if you were the Eagles, draft Jake Fisher in the first round and Nelson Aguilar in the second round, probably the most popular combination of picks in mock drafts these days, or would you rather draft your boy Breshad Perriman in the first round and Oregon center/interior lineman Hronis Grasu in the second round? Which tandem would you prefer for the Eagles?
The second one.
Okay.
I think I would go second one, too. I mean, Perriman, to me, if the comparison comes down to Perriman versus Aguilar. I think Perriman would be far more effective in this offense. And Aguilar, I think, is a good player and would be effective as well. But adding Perriman's vertical ability, his size to the receiving core would be a big thing. And then Grasso, I think, could slide in and play guard as well. So,
see, I like the first option better because I understand the upside with Perriman, but I like the Jake Fisher component to it where you're looking at the Eagles' offensive line. Jason Peters, look, physical marvel, could play for a number of years, but I'm looking down the road at that position, and I think that Fisher can come in day one and possibly be your starting guard.
I think, the leaning of the first one is that you have the future tackle in Fisher who can play guard now. If you have Grasso, you're still going to need to find another tackle down the road. But if you think Perriman is the stud that you guys do, I think you go with that one. I guess I would believe
you're
and I would go with
hemming
Perriman
and hawing
as well.
Here.
I'm not hemming and hawing about it.
Bo is the king of hemming and hawing.
Yeah.
But I like Aguilar as well, so it's not it's a complete loss.
Right,
that
of course. Okay. We're talking safeties now. Would you rather draft Landon Collins in the first round or Demarius Randall in the second round or Curtis Drummond in the third round.
I would take, based on what you told me, I would take Demarius Randall in the second round in a heartbeat because I think he's a better prospect than Landon Collins.
Ooh.
There you go.
Go on. Tell us more.
I think he's a better prospect.
Okay.
He's a better
he
mover.
He can do more. Yeah.
He can do more. The Eagles like to play with interchangeable safeties. I personally, based on my film study, Bo,
okay,
don't see Landon Collins as an interchangeable safety with multidimensional skills.
Okay.
I'm going to agree with Greg on this one. More so, I think that you are limited with Collins. Don't know if I'm dying for him there at number 20. I know he's a popular mock draft pick. And I think Randall could offer more from the safety spot. So from the value standpoint also that you're not using that first round pick on him.
Yeah, for me it's between Randall and Drummond. I would not want Collins at 20. But well, you go ahead, Frank.
I'm going to go clean sweep. I'm going to go Randall in the second round. I mean, in terms of the interchangeable traits that you have with those two guys. And look, I like Drummond. I think Drummond's a good player, but I think that Randall's a better player. And
who
he
also has corner traits, by the way.
Sure thing.
You could put him in the slot, too, if you really wanted to.
No question. He did it at Arizona State, and
yep,
he did it at a pretty good level. So
right,
I would go Randall.
Clean sweep it is. All right, next. Would you rather have Byron Jones in the first round and Central Arkansas wide receiver Desmond Lewis in the third round? So they're going first and third here. Or Jalen Strong in the first round and Stanford cornerback Alex Carter in the third round?
I would go with the first one personally.
You're a big Desmond Lewis fan.
I am. And I think the way Chip Kelly runs offense, I think that the delineations at receiver are really blurred. So I think he uses people in a lot of different ways, different movement shifts, different alignments. So, I don't think Desmond Lewis in a Chip Kelly offense is just a one-spot player. I think he's a multiple player.
Okay.
I agree with Greg. I really like Byron Jones.
Yeah.
I think that's what's putting it over the top for me right there.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with those two guys. I mean, I would go, obviously, Byron Jones, we've talked about in the past. We talked about him pretty extensively last week. A guy who is able to play at the line of scrimmage in a press situation, very physical at the line of scrimmage, good tackler, very smart player, zone aware, can play man, can play zone. I really like Byron Jones.
I think the way things are going, there's a chance that Byron Jones will not be there at 20. But I think I would agree with you guys. Okay, next. We're going. We might want to write this down because it's 3 versus 3. Okay.
Jeez.
First round, Max Williams, the Minnesota tight end.
Double X, okay.
Who has not been linked to the Eagles in any way, but, you know, who knows. Second round, Preston Smith, the Mississippi State pass rusher.
Like Preston Smith a
and
lot.
And third round, Ali Marpet, the Hobart offensive lineman. Or, in the first round, Owa Odigizua, the pass rusher from UCLA. Cedric Abui in the second round from Texas A&M, coming off the torn ACL, but a talented offensive lineman. And third round, Tyler Croft, the Rutgers tight end.
I would go for the second one.
Okay. Any reason why?
Probably because I like the players better.
Owa, you're a big
fan
of?
I think double O, as I will call him.
Sure. That's fine.
I actually just finished watching a ton of UCLA defense, so he's fresh in my mind. And I think there's a this reverts back to our earlier conversation. I think there's a player who's has relative inexperience playing football, but is extremely athletic. There's a guy, I guess you talk about a potential upside.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could make a case he's not quite this guy, but I think there's traits of Ziggy Ansah potentially down the road. So he's a player I really like on film. So as soon as you mentioned his name, and I really like Tyler Croft, by the way.
Okay.
So as soon as you mentioned double O there at 20, I figured unless you mentioned two guys I hated that I was going to go with the second one.
He is Fran's favorite player of the draft. I think it's...
He's up there. He's up there for sure. I haven't come out with who my favorite player is,
okay,
but he's definitely up there. He would be in the running.
You're not going to answer who your favorite player is.
At some point, maybe I will. I would go with the second.
He's
group
going
too.
With second.
Yeah,
he knows. We know he loves Diggy Zoo.
He doesn't love Abui. That's the.
I don't,
one.
And that's what almost threw me off there. But I'll still go with the second.
I think I might go with the first one because I'll give Chip Kelly the big weapon there with Max Williams. I know you guys are big on Preston Smith, and then you got Marpet. Bo, I know you're a big fan of.
I think I would go with the first one too.
Somebody could play in the interior. The only thing with Chip Kelly is he's not really gone with small school guys.
That's good. True. That's a valid point.
So that's going to be a question now. Is it just a matter of there hasn't been a good prospect, or
but was he? But really was he with the one making the picks? That's the other question.
Also a good point.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Two more. Well, maybe three more. All right, Greg. Eagles are on the clock at 20. All right? These are the players on the board. I just want to know who you would pick. Okay?
All right.
Would you rather draft? Assume these are the six players on the board. TJ Clemmings from Pittsburgh.
Well, there'll be a lot of people on the board, but.
Yes. Between these.
Brilliant.
Jake Fisher from Oregon. Wake Forest cornerback Kevin Johnson.
Okay.
Kentucky pass rusher Bud Dupree. Jalen Collins, the cornerback from LSU. Or Jalen Strong, the Arizona State wide receiver. So the other guys who have been mentioned in this realm for the Eagles are off the board. Landon Collins is gone. Lyle Collins is gone.
It doesn't matter.
Right?
So you're giving us these six names, right? I would draft Jalen Collins.
Interesting. You like Jalen Collins.
I really like Jalen Collins.
Okay.
I'm fortifying the offensive line with Jake Fisher of all those.
Okay.
I'm going to go Kevin Johnson from that group. I think Kevin Johnson, and I hate to give you the tip of the cap there, but in terms of a press corner, a guy that's coming out of college, I think he's pretty technically sound. I think he's very patient in the line of scrimmage, very zone aware. I think he does a lot of things really well. So I would go Kevin Johnson.
Go Deeks.
And I was not, for me, it was between the two corners.
Okay.
I just happened to like Collins a little bit more. I like Kevin Johnson a lot. I just like Collins a little bit more because of the physical attributes.
So Johnson would be my second choice.
Oh.
I would think I would actually go with Bud Dupree. And I know that there the other positions are more need positions for the Eagles, but I think Bud Dupree has the upside to be more of a difference maker than the other players.
It's a fair point.
So there you go.
Let me ask one thing about Jalen Collins now. Is he a guy who, Greg, you put in a situation where he could be a better pro because he didn't have a lot of experience at the college level? He has the physical traits, but I guess it goes back, can he be coachable in his cornerback a position where you worry about that a little bit more?
Well, I think you'd worry about that at any position, C-Mac. And again, like I've always said, I don't know the kids.
Of course.
But I think his physical traits for an NFL corner, press man corner, are high level. So assuming all things being equal, then I think that, to me, Jalen Collins down the road, whenever that is, maybe it's second year, it doesn't matter, could end up being the best corner in this draft.
All right, there you go. All right, last one for you, Greg, because you watch the tape, you talk to coaches. Would you rather never be able to talk to a coach again or never be able to watch the tape again?
Probably the first one.
Okay. I think that's reasonable.
Because I like to trust what I see. I like to see it myself.
You got to watch the tape. Absolutely.
I got to watch the tape.
Fran?
I would agree. I would rather watch the tape.
Okay.
The thing with Greg is he knows so much at this point.
Well, I just make it up, C-Mac.
That's all fair.
Yeah.
So do we all.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, there you go. How did you feel your first trip in Would You Rather?
I thought it was pretty good. Okay. I had no problem with it at all.
I think you did pretty well. Yeah, you didn't sweat. You were good.
No.
But, Greg, you're going to be a part of our Eagles Draft Central coverage.
I am.
April 30th. We're very much looking forward to that.
As am I.
You'll be in studio. We have a preview show the Wednesday before the draft, Wednesday, April 29th at 7:30 p.m., and then we will be live a half hour before the draft on April 30th at 7:30 p.m., once again.
You got to love the first round.
It's going to be so exciting. I'll be in Chicago for it.
You will?
I will be in Chicago,
Good
yes.
for you.
Yes. So you and Bo will get to have all the fun here with Fran in Philadelphia. Behave
Among
yourself.
Others.
Among many others, yes.
A
yes.
cast of thousands.
Yes. Dave Spadaro, right. Merrill Reese, of course.
Tens.
Ike Reese will be in.
Ike Reese as well.
That's right.
No, we're very much looking forward to having your insight and analysis.
Why?
Your personality.
Because I watch the tape.
Yes.
There you go.
That's exactly correct.
And that's what we learned today. If you take nothing else away from this conversation, you know that Greg Cosell, NFL Films senior producer, watches the tape. Greg, phenomenal work as always. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Journey to the Draft podcast presented by AAA.